Now on to our regular roundtable. We're going to continue our discussion on the CBC meeting with the president, as well as discuss the anti-gay comments surrounding a former NBA star. Joining our panel today are Joe Davidson, an editor for The Washington Post, Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, and Nat Irvin, professor of future studies at Wake Forest University and a columnist for the Winston-Salem Journal. Hello, everybody. Nice to have you back.
Hello.
Hello, Tony.
Let's start right here. It took a while, of course, but the president finally sat down with the members of the Congressional Black Caucus yesterday, as you heard, and you also just heard Artur Davis talk about that meeting. Here's my question, and Mary Frances, I'm coming to you first. How much do you make of this meeting? Because two things are different, it seems to me. The first is the president needs friends on both sides of the aisle. And secondly, as the congressman pointed out, the CBC has members now in position of influence as committee chairs.
Well, the reason why the president has been so ubiquitous in the media in the last few days is because they have a new strategy of him meeting, engaging, talking, being everywhere to try to show that he is relevant. The Black Caucus clearly is relevant now because of all those chairmanships and the rest of it. People got a lot of them because they just have a whole lot of seat time up there. They stayed forever and ever. And so he meets with them. That's another event that they can check off that he did and that he showed his respect and he invited them over. Nobody expected anything to happen. I don't think any of the caucus members are dumb enough to think something was going to come out of these meetings. But it's another thing for Bush to do. One thing they should have been pushing him on, and I'm sure they did from all accounts, is on the Katrina response. And the Homeland Security Committee with Benny Thompson needs to be faster. The Democrats aren't fast enough. They could have been better used their time working on that because people are leaving New Orleans now, who are the stable people in the community, rather than spending whatever length of time they spent with Bush. But it was a ceremonial meeting. It was symbolic. They got it out of the way. He asked them because it met his needs, and they went because that's what you do when you're invited over there. And that's the end of that, and we can move on.
Well, Joe Davidson, what? That's really succinctly put, I have to say.
Gee, Mary.
Whoa. But here's my question, though, to follow up on Mary's point, Joe, from the CBC's perspective, what must they do? What are they able to do to try to push their legislative agenda through the president?
Well, what they can do is first get it through Congress, because whatever they do, it has to go through the entire Congress before it gets to the White House for his signature. And clearly, as Congressman Davis pointed out, they have a significant amount of power in the House of Representatives and therefore the entire Congress, much more than they have had before with these five committee chairmanships that he mentioned. There's some almost 15, I think, subcommittee chairmanships that caucus members chair. So this represents a significant degree of political power that other members of the House, the Congress as a whole, and then ultimately the White House will have to deal with if the caucus, that is, becomes a solid, cohesive group, at least on those issues where all members agree, and not all members of the caucus agree on every issue, and therefore can influence legislation, the legislation that ultimately will have to be signed or vetoed or pocket vetoed by the president.
Nat, let me get you in here and ask you in a follow-up also to Mary's point that going is sort of pro forma. Would it have been strategically better perhaps to not go?
Oh, absolutely not, Tony. You've got to go visit with the president. He is perhaps the lamest of the lame ducks in recent times, but you have to, as Congressman Davis suggested, this is part of the formality. This is the business of government, so you have to do that. But I think that the at least two things struck me about this opportunity. Joe and Mary covered them, and I'll cover just one other. And that is this, that the domestic agenda right now for the president, even his allies are saying that he doesn't really have any energy behind it. So whether or not the Congressional Black Caucus has an agenda might not be as important as the fact that the president himself is lacking the energy to be able to get something done on immigration, for example, on energy policy, on say education, healthcare. These issues are important to America, and to the extent that the Congressional Black Caucus can lead the country, can help lead this Congress toward solving these issues, the president may very well follow them. And I guess the other thing is to say this, that it's also an illustration when you see a president come and have the kind of conversation he had yesterday, apparently, and to kind of look, as Mary's talked about, he's out, you know, trying to be with other people, talking, you know, doing much more of this public relations kind of thing. It's an indication of just how badly we are distracted with Iraq.
Mm. Well, you know, I guess if the congressman is correct in his assessment, we won't be talking about Bush and the CBC meeting ever again.
Well, Tony, usually when they have these meetings with people at the White House, whoever it is, if the White House is serious and they've got some serious policy discussion, the White House comes out afterwards with a statement about what was accomplished at the meeting and what they did and so on. But this was obviously just, you know, it was like it's Black History Month. And they met with the Black Caucus. That's basically what
You're right. And, you know, I know, Joe,
the Democratic.
You work for the Washington Post, and I couldn't even find a story online about that visit yesterday.
It was not there.
Yeah,
I noticed that. I guess that's an indication of how important that meeting was, at least to the editors on our national desk.
Well, you guys need to have a discussion at your next newsroom editors meeting.
Right.
I'll tell them
you said so. Tell them to put substance-less things in the
style.
Oh, my. You're listening to NPR's News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox, in case you're just tuning in. With us on today's roundtable are Joe Davidson, an editor for The Washington Post, Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, and Nat Irvin, professor of future studies at Wake Forest University and a columnist for the Winston-Salem Journal. All right, let's move on to topic number two. You don't even have to have been a fan of sports or a fan of the NBA to have heard all this hoorah this week about the former NBA player John Amici, who has written a book and who has come out and announced that he is gay and is the first, as far as we know, former NBA player to publicly announce his homosexuality. Now, the reaction has been swift, and it's been generally positive, but not always. And some of it has been very mixed. And in fact, former NBA All-Star Tim Hardaway may have given one of the reasons that Amici didn't come out before now. Listen to what he had to say this week about having a gay teammate.
I hate gay people, so, you know, I let it be known. I don't like gay people. I don't like to be around gay people. I don't, you know, I'm homophobic. I don't like it. It shouldn't be in the world for that or in the United States for it. So, yeah, I don't like it.
So now, to be fair to Tim Hardaway, of course, he has apologized for those comments, saying he shouldn't have said them.
Has he gone yet to treatment?
To therapy?
For his anger
well, that,
therapy
that'll be coming. And he won't be doing it in Las Vegas because NBA Commissioner David Stern, reacting to those comments, has removed Hardaway from any appearances in Las Vegas at the All-Star Weekend this weekend. Now, here's my question. I want to talk. Also, let me just say also that Amici himself said at least Hardaway was honest in his remarks. This has been all over sports talk radio like crazy. And this is the second high-profile black man who has voiced anti-gay opinions publicly in the last few months. And there is a feeling that has been expressed publicly again on talk radio and elsewhere that homophobia is very high and, in fact, is higher in the black community than others. So here's my question to you. I'll come to you first, Joe. Is this homophobia? Is this the prejudice that black folks have that no one wants to recognize?
Well, I think a lot of people do recognize it, and a lot of people do talk about it. And I certainly hear a lot of comments about within the black community about how homophobic the black community is. And I think there is a high level, what I would consider, too high a level of homophobia, bigotry within the black community. If it is, in fact, higher than in the white community, though, you know, I'm really not sure, because when you look at all of the laws and various things that and societal pressures that have been put that have been forced against members of the gay community, things that clearly have a bias against members of the gay community, most of those don't come in a structured and institutional way from black people. Having said that, I do think that black people, and if that's the topic of our conversation, certainly from my point of view, have a a level of homophobia, bias that is really unconscionable, particularly when you consider our history.
You know, Mary Frances, some people suggest that this is rooted, this homophobia, if you in fact agree with that characterization of it from our community's standpoint, that the root of some of this is the church.
Absolutely, and the EEOC has just done a study that shows that male-on-male harassment of people because they think they're gay is on the rise. All the incidents of people doing stuff, locker room-type stuff, and on-the-job kind of stuff, perceiving people are gay. And this homophobia is reinforced in the church. And one of the problems is it interferes with us not only in the sense that your moral sense is outraged, but dealing with AIDS, for example, and the HIV crisis, all the homophobia, that's the whole down-low thing related to that, and black women, you know, getting infected and the like. So we are killing ourselves. And if you go to church, or if, as I do, or if you listen to gospel music stations, as I do, you cannot miss sermons that reinforce all of the homophobia about sinners and this and this. And it happens at the same time. We're so doggone illogical that we all know that if two kinds of people didn't go to church on Sunday, the black church would close. Women, black women, and gay men. If they didn't go, the church would close. And sometimes it's a choir director and it's a preacher. And yet this homophobia is persistently and consistently enforced. And so Tim Hardaway was being ignorant. He was expressing these beliefs that are reinforced throughout the community. Not that white people, as Joe says, white people are homophobic too. You can see it everywhere in the church and so on. But it's tragic with black people. And it is time for him to go to get his therapy and come back out and say that he's changed.
Personality rehab.
Where do you see this, Nat, where do you see this leading us? I mean, are we going to be able, as a community, work our way through this and come to the other side, so to speak? Or are we just going to be stuck with this this sense of homophobia because it is so connected to Christian beliefs in the black church?
Well, you know, the first thing that comes to mind from a political standpoint, it is, and it is also moral as well, it is the issue of marriage. That's where, when we deal with homophobia in one context, from a just political and practical standpoint, that's where the church runs into its greatest hurdle because we have such a strong bias against same-sex marriage. So that's the first thing. But in terms of coming in contact, I mean, in the context of homophobia, as it has been experienced within the black experience, the black American experience, the African experience, it's no question we have made peace with it when it comes to singing in the choir, as Barry pointed out, the musicians. We know this is a reality within our church experience. Everybody has recognized gay people for the longest time. What has been difficult for us to do when you translate that into the political experience is then to say that the experiences that, quote, white homosexuals would have would be put on somehow that they would have the same sort of legal standing as the challenges that black folks were facing. And so we had to go through that stage of where we didn't agree that it was the same thing, same-sex homosexuals had the same legal challenges as black folks did. So where we're headed, I think, Joe, is because of AIDS, we are going to come to grips with our attitudes about this. And I frankly see this comment by Hardaway as actually being a blessing because when you hear it, it sounds extraordinarily dated and extraordinarily ignorant, and I think the next generation of young black people will see it for what it is. And the other thing is that it's very costly to have these kinds of attitudes, especially if you think you're going to play a role in the public arena.
This is a good place.
Tony, I've got to tell you, the National Black Justice Coalition is working with black church summits and working on this issue, and there are church people trying to get rid of the homophobia in the church.
That's good to hear. Our time has run out. From NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., Joe Davidson, an editor for The Washington Post, Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, and Nat Irvin, professor of future studies at Wake Forest University. Everybody, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Good weekend.